Hello again, Internet, and welcome again to another episode of F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined again after a considerable absence away by my man in NY, Eric Asperschlager. How are you, sir?
I'm good. A little peek behind the curtain of the listeners at home, but Patrick's intro was originally much slower. I told him to speed it up, and I think it sounds a lot better.
I was able to adjust to your notes and let it never be said that I can't take direction.
I think it's a hit. I don't know.
Something snappy. Something peppy. Tonight we're talking about 1996's That Thing You Do, written and directed by one Tom Hanks. But before we talk about that, I have to get through all the nonsense that we say at the start of the show, like the fact that you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. You can find us in the iTunes store or at DVD Verdict Presents. Thank you to Michael Staley and everybody at DVD Verdict for carrying our show now on Thursdays. There's a lot of ways to find our show, so it sounds like you found it already. Basically, if you're hearing this, you found it. But if you want to go back and hear other shows, these are the ways to do it, people.
I like that your show's on Thursdays. It makes you like the Friends or Seinfeld.
Yeah, we're like the must world. See TV of podcasts.
Listen, must listen. Internet audio. We're more like the
single guy of podcasts, or the Veronica's Closet, the Caroline in the City.
Someday we hope to be Joey.
Oh, if only we could be Joey. Hey, Eric, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I've actually been to the theater, which I'm loath to admit on a movie watching podcast, but I go to the theater so infrequently, just because we have a local theater. They don't show very much. It's a cheap theater, which is great, and it's an old building, which is also cool. But they tend to show more mainstream stuff because they want to bring people in. I've been a couple times in the past few weeks, most recently to see the brand new Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Nice. I have not seen it.
Oh, so we can't discuss it.
Well, you can discuss it at me.
But, I will.
But not with me.
All right, that's okay. I'd hoped perhaps. It's always disappointing when I've seen a movie that you either haven't or aren't talking about. I remember when I saw Captain America, and you didn't do a Captain America podcast. And I was like, well, finally, there'd be a podcast I could listen to all the way through. Luckily, I was able to listen to your Cowboys and Aliens podcast because I just saw that recently. Although, unluckily, I saw Cowboys and Aliens to listen to it, but it wasn't that bad. But yeah, Rise of the Planet of the Apes was a real surprise, maybe less so because the internet was in full-on ape frenzy mode before I saw it. But that is a good movie. I think that it does a lot of the things that this podcast often complains about, or doesn't do things this podcast often complains about. It plays honest with the story. It lets it develop in kind of an organic way. It gives the audience a lot of credit. The fact that a lot of the movie is acted by apes that aren't even there, CGI apes, but apes that don't speak English really. So you have to kind of rely a lot on what's happening on screen to understand what's going on. And they do that really well. It kind of merges smoothly from sci-fi movie to monster movie to prison movie to, all these things would pop into my head like, oh, this is like a Gremlin scene. And oh, this is like an ET scene. And oh, this is like Frankenstein. And it really comes together, in an ending action scene, which, and rare for movies these days, you can tell what's going on, where people are, and what the goals are, and they really pull it off extremely well. Speaking of the apes that aren't there, there's some pretty amazing CGI work in this movie. Andy Serkis, the man no one ever sees unless he's, I don't know, something hulking and not real, just does a really amazing job as the lead ape. So I don't know if he's going to win the best actor. Can you be nominated for an acting performance for not being in a movie?
I feel like it's sort of only a matter of time. I mean, at some point, I think they're going to have to recognize one of those performances. It may not be this one, but it may be one in the future.
Yeah, it'll probably get a nod for special effects or something. Mm-hmm. some consolation prize like that. So until they have a Best Ape Award, he's probably not going to win. But it's a very compelling performance. So I really enjoy that, and I really recommend it both as a, you know, as a genre fun genre summer flick, and also as a, you know, a well written, well paced movie. So
I'm excited to see it. Honestly, and I'm a fan of the Planet of the Apes movies. Obviously, save for the Tim Burton, which you don't even have to say at this point. But none of the trailers really did much for me, and it wasn't until word of mouth started to come out, and that the word of mouth was really solid, that I was like, oh, wow, I'm actually kind of excited to see this movie now, instead of just feeling sort of obligated because it's the new big summer movie, which is why I've seen so many things this summer. But I'm genuinely excited to see it.
And I saw it without having, again, hard to admit this, but without having seen any of the Planet of the Apes movies all the way through up to this point. So I definitely want to go back and check them out now. Skipping, of course, the Tim Burton one.
Have you ever seen the Tim Burton one?
I feel like I've seen bits and pieces, but no, I just skipped it when it was out.
It's a total waste of time. And I'm a big fan of the original series because it's one of these things that, like, the longer it goes on, and sort of the more that the mainstream audience kind of drops away from it, it gets weirder and more interesting and better. It's neat to watch all of them all the way through. But you also saw Cowboys and Aliens and Captain America. Do you care to discuss either one of those, sir?
I can briefly. Yeah. Cowboys and Aliens. I think listening to your podcast from last week, which I did driving home from the theater.
Nice.
So everything fresh in the mind. I think I fall somewhere between you and JB. While I was watching it, I was swept up enough that all the stuff that you rightly pointed out didn't bother me too much. There were a few points where I thought, oh, that is convenient, isn't it? And there are some plot twists that are silly. And as it goes along, it becomes more and more just your kind of cliched, you know, summer movie. But the Western stuff is fun enough for long enough that I didn't regret seeing it, especially since I had free tickets to see it. So,
oh, can't go wrong there.
I can't. So I think my expectations are already at a, the lights are off. They win.
In the words of JB, it was well worth the nothing you paid for it.
It was, absolutely. Captain America, I really enjoyed. I wished that our local theater had gotten any of the other Marvel movies this summer, just because I was interested in seeing X-Men, and I probably would have watched Thor, and I will at some point. But Captain America, I think, is one of the more successful superhero movies, at least of late, as far as being a movie that feels like a comic book, feels like a movie, is, you know, save for the kind of montage section in the middle, pretty well paced. I think that the buildup is really satisfying, and I think, you know, they did a good job. It's too bad that it has to tie into the Avengers movie, because it really does, you know, where it's going to go, and it goes there very abruptly once you get to that point. So, but other than that, I thought it worked. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, that was one of the most pleasant surprises of the summer. I didn't know what to expect going into it. And I'm kind of burned out, obviously, on superhero and comic book movies, which I know you are as well. And I really liked it. And yeah, like you said, I think in the future I may just turn the movie off at a certain point. Like, oh, there's the perfect spot to end it. And I'm going to turn it off and ignore the next 5 minutes, because it's unfortunate that they have to mess up what is otherwise, I think, a really great ending to that movie.
I mean, I know that I'm pretty sure they're planning on doing a sequel at some point, because it is a movie. But I wish that they had been able to end it in such a way that they could continue on in that universe. However, I mean, I guess it's a comic book. They could do whatever they want. They can shake it up, but
they could send him back in time. But speaking of superhero movies, and perhaps your frustration and or disappointment with superhero movies, now, you also recently watched and reviewed for DVD Verdict, and everyone should go read this review because it's really great, James Gunn's Super.
Yeah, speaking of nice surprises, I mean, I guess I heard a lot of good things going in from you. I know that I read your review, and thankfully, your review warned me off of reading Roger Ebert's review.
Oh, my gosh. And you know what? I think you're the first person, because the day that review came out, I sent, you know, emails or text messages like to my wife and to JB or whoever and said, like, do not read Roger Ebert's review. And to a person, every single one of them said, oh, I couldn't resist. I had to find out what he spoiled. Like, no, that's the opposite of what I said to do.
I know. And I'm certainly not going to say anything here, but that moment that he spoiled, which comes late in the movie too, yeah, which is shocking, shocked me. I did not see that coming. I think that it's super effective. If you don't know, it's going to happen, and it totally fits the tone of the movie and kind of drives everything from that point onward. And it's really too bad. But yeah, that is a really great movie.
Yeah.
I, like we said, I've gotten really burned out on comic book movies, not only because there are so many of them, but just because they don't seem terribly interested in taking the strengths of filmmaking and applying what's good about comic books to them. It's either just a kind of a straight telling of a comic book, which doesn't really work in a 2-hour format. Comic books are these long, kind of silly, kind of epic stories where there are all these twists and turns and people die and come back to life and stuff. And it requires sitting down and reading them for a long period of time. Or they just sort of ignore the comic booky aspects and just kind of take the characters. I mean, as much as I enjoy Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, I don't really think of them as comic book movies after a certain point. And in fact, rewatching The Dark Knight not terribly long ago, I was struck by how the worst things about the movie for me were anytime it was just Batman talking to someone.
Right.
Like, the stuff that would be, totally cool in the comic book, it's Batman, he's his character, but anything that had to do with Batman in costume was just sort of like, well, that's a little silly, isn't it? But yeah, super, super kind of really, it's easy to draw comparisons with Kick-Ass, obviously, because it's a story about a guy who isn't a superhero, who decides to become one, but that's, and it's also very violent, but it's also unfair to compare the two because they're different movies. I think Super is more successful just because James Gunn is willing to go further with the ideas, kind of focus in on one character instead of splitting it between several, and just everything from the script to the costumes to the special effects to just the really over the top violence and the performances. I mean, it's got some great performances from Rainn Wilson, Liv Tyler, and Ellen Page, and Kevin Bacon is great in it. So I definitely recommend it, as long as you have, I think I said in my review, as long as you have the stomach for it. Because it does get pretty, pretty violent at times.
It does, and it plays kind of a weird game with the violence. And I think I said this in the review that I wrote. Because when I saw it, there are parts that definitely are played sort of for comedy, and so it makes sense to laugh. And then there's a lot of tonal shifts in the movie, and people, I think, were so either unwilling to go where the movie was going or not prepared for those shifts in tone that they continued to laugh at moments that were not funny at all. And so I think for some people, I think it's a frustrating experience because they're so used to a movie kind of being one thing or another, and mm-hmm. Super is a lot of things at one time. And so I think it may put some people off, but yeah, I think anybody who's obviously listening to this podcast certainly will take something away from it, even if they don't like it. I think there's a lot to appreciate in it.
Yeah, you could even argue that there's less violence in this movie than in a lot of mainstream movies, but because it's done in such a in-your-face, off-putting, really kind of sickening way,
right,
on purpose. I think one of the strengths of the movie is that it treats violence like it's real. It's not just some slickly edited action movie where thousands of people are killed, but yay for the good guys.
Right, exactly.
So it definitely straddles that line very well. So yeah, I highly recommend Super.
Awesome. I haven't seen it. I mean, I've seen some stuff lately that I think is going to have to wait until we do our end of the summer show. But just recently on DVD, I caught up with the original The Blob. I had never seen the original Blob. I've seen the remake a bunch of times. I'm a big, big fan of the remake. I had never seen the original film. And there's certainly things to like about it. I'm a sucker for sort of the 50s Technicolor style, so I liked just the way it looked. I like that it's a movie that is very much part of building up sort of even the idea of the American teenager that sort of movies created in the 1950s. And this definitely plays a huge part in that. I mean, by the end of the movie, we're convincing the principal of the high school to throw a rock through the window. Like, it's just the teenagers rule. But there's very little of the blob in it. There's a few shots here and there. I don't know. And I don't think I've seen a lot of movies with Steve McQueen. I think I've seen some of the better known ones. And this was obviously one of his earliest movies because he's still billed as Stephen McQueen. But watching The Blob, I would have no indication that Steve McQueen would ever go on to be like an iconic movie star. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a schlub. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. He wasn't like Mr. Super Cool yet. I don't know. Have you ever seen the original Blob?
I think I have when I was younger. I always carried with me the, the image of the old man who finds the blob and it gets on the stick.
Yeah.
And then when I recently watched the remake, I thought, oh, I must have seen this. But as I was watching it, I thought, there's no way my parents let me watch this. So I must have seen the original because I don't remember people melting. So.
Yeah, right. Did you like the remake?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it's kind of when I was going through a whole series of like late 70s and the 80s practical horror movies, and that, you know, totally holds up. It's a creepy little movie.
Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. Yeah. It's violent, and it does not play nice with people, characters that you think in other movies always get away, you know. I won't say much more, but and I also saw Unknown, which came out earlier this year with Liam Neeson and January Jones. It looked sort of like a Taken ripoff. He's a guy who gets in a car accident. He has amnesia. He's trying to figure out who he is. I don't recommend it. I don't know. It was very generic. I mean, I like Taken enough, but that's because, like, it's silly and it's mm-hmm. short and it's focused and it has a lot of action. And Unknown has none of those qualities. It's overlong. It takes itself very seriously. There's hardly any action. So watch Taken instead.
It's kind of hard for me to want to watch anything with January Jones in it.
Oh, boy. And I'll tell you what. Do you watch Mad Men?
Yeah. And she serves a function in Mad Men, but that's kind of about it.
I think she's good on Mad Men, but mm-hmm. it's a testament to casting versus performance because right. – I suspect that's who she is. Right. And when you see her in other movies, I mean, it really makes you appreciate what they're able to do with her on Mad Men. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just everyone else acting around her. I don't know. Because, man, in both Unknown and X-Men First Class, you just cannot imagine how she's in movies, how she's a professional actress of any right. kind. Anyway, let's talk about That Thing You Do.
Yeah, speaking of Liv Tyler movies.
Nice. Good segue there. That Thing You Do came out in 96. I'm just going to give a little personal story about it. You know, a lot of times on F This Movie, we talk about sort of big blockbuster movies or sort of well-known, more cult movies. That Thing You Do is sort of a different animal than what we usually talk about. It's a movie that I think once upon a time, not a lot of people have seen. I think after many, many reruns on cable and home video, I think a lot of people have been exposed to this movie. But I don't think it's a movie that has ever had much serious critical discussion about it. It's just like, I saw it. It was cute. And I think there are things to talk about in this movie. You know, as a movie fan, obviously I'm quick to say like, oh, that's one of my favorite movies. And I do have a pretty long list of movies that I really, really love. And That Thing You Do is on that list. I mean, this is a movie that I can almost recite backwards and forwards. I've seen it so many times. In 96, when it came out, they were doing a sneak preview of the movie as a double feature with Independence Day. So this was maybe a month or two after Independence Day had come out. And if you went to see the sneak preview of That Thing You Do, you could stick around and see Independence Day afterwards. And I didn't know much about the movie, but I'd seen the trailer and I liked Tom Hanks. And I thought, well, it's two movies for the price of one. I liked Independence Day. I'll go see it again, blah, blah, blah. So we see That Thing You Do. And I loved the movie so much that I had to leave. I didn't want to stay and see Independence Day because it was going to take me out of that rush that I got from That Thing You Do. So instead, I drove right over to Tower Records and bought the soundtrack and brought it home and just played it over and over and over and tried to learn the songs on the bass and all that. I saw that movie probably 7 or 8 times theatrically, and it wasn't playing for very long because it didn't make a lot of money. It's the first movie I can think of that, like, I went to see at a matinee and then went home, and as the day went on, I started to get in a bad mood or things went wrong. I don't remember, to the point where I needed sort of a pick me up. So I drove back to the theater and saw it again that night because I just, I wanted to be back in that movie. So I'm a big, huge fan of the movie. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I went to see it in the theater. I was in college, and just some people I knew were going. I didn't know anything about it. I'd seen some commercials, and it looked like, yeah, like, you know, it's probably not going to be very good, but, you know, evening out. And I loved it. Same as you, I did not go back 8 times to see it, but but yeah, it's sort of rare to see a movie that's this kind of peppy and joyous that is never corny. It just kind of captures you the whole way through. And I really loved it. It's great to have those movie experiences where you didn't know anything going in and it becomes just this, you know, right, amazing thing. So yeah, I'm with
such
you.
Such a sort of a happy surprise. And one of the reasons that you and I got to talk, well, there's a couple of reasons you and I have gotten to talking about it. One is that the main song, That Thing You Do, which plays a bunch of times in the movie, and I don't even care because I never get sick of it.
Me neither. It's amazing.
But the movie does a very clever thing, though, that every time you hear it, it's a little, I don't know if I would say better, because I love all the versions of it, but there's more going on in the song. It's a little more produced. There's new instrumentation. There's sort of a new arrangement, so that by the time you see it on the TV broadcast at the end, I mean, it's such a different song than what it started out as. But that it's written by a guy named Adam Schlesinger, who, of course, is one of the two founding members of a band called Fountains of Wayne that we are both big fans of. And that was one of those things, again, in 96, it was like I had just started listening to Fountains of Wayne because I think their album had just come out.
Yep.
And I loved That Thing You Do, and the two things were totally independent of one another. And then all of a sudden, I'm clued into the fact that this guy wrote the song, and it was like, my worlds are colliding. This is so great. It was like such a happy connection for me.
Yeah, it was such I think I found out way later, but it didn't surprise me at all. I was like, oh yeah, that's such a great and catchy song. And oh yeah, Fountains of Wayne, they're awesome. It makes total sense.
And do you remember, I don't know if you pay much attention to the Academy Awards or whatever, but in 97, the song was nominated for Best Song. And I was super excited because I was positive that meant they were going to bring the Wonders out on stage and have them perform the song, because I had watched like the HBO making of, and I knew that like these guys all learned how to play, or they already knew or whatever. So I was like, well, they'll be capable enough. For a long time, I thought it was actually Jonathan Scheck singing, and then I found out it was Mike Viola. But I was positive they were going to bring the Wonders out and have them perform live. And instead it was this weird production number about like a band's rise through fame or whatever. It was like this Twyla Tharp dance thing instead of having a band play the song. Huge disappointment.
I remember watching it vaguely. I must have blocked most of it out.
Crushing disappointment. But one of the other reasons that we got to talking about it was because you, sir, I believe, are on record as being a huge fan of sort of the 60s, specifically, sort of pop.
Yeah, I mean, music. A lot of the British Invasion stuff, the garage, you know, your Nuggets type of stuff. I mean, we talked a lot about this on the Rushmore podcast.
Right. Does the movie then hold any more significance for you because it's sort of about that scene? I mean, it's not really about British Invasion as much as it is about sort of 60s pop music or one hit wonders.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of catchy pop music of that stripe. I know that it, you know, takes a lot of flack these days because it's, you know, simplistic or whatever, but I mean, Fountains of Wayne, who just released a new album this past week or last week, do what they do so well, the kind of the catchy, you know, tight, well-constructed pop song. And I've always loved that. I mean, you can come up with a, you know, a really good hook in a couple minutes, then I am with you 100%. So from that perspective, yeah, totally. A lot of the other music in the movie is not like that, but I'm sure that played a part in my enjoying it.
Well, and I love how much the movie gets, you know, it never plays any actual songs from the era. All of the songs are original, several of which were co-written by Tom Hanks.
I know. I just found that out when I watched it the other day. I was like, yeah. You know, watch the credits.
And I love the way that all of the different sort of styles are approximated. So you get Diane Dane doing a sort of a Skeeter Davis, like instead of the end of the world, we get Your World Goes On, But For Me, My World Is Over. And we get the Chanterelles as sort of the girl group, and we get the Wonders, and we get Mr. Downtown or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's you get a sort of a sampling of all these different kinds of musical stylings. The thing I've always loved the most about That Thing You Do, and the thing that I don't think the movie has ever gotten enough credit for, is how, and this is sort of a weird observation to make about the movie, maybe, I think it's one of the more sort of subtle and nuanced movies I've seen, especially for, you know, it seems to be so simplistic on the surface, but all of the dialogue has always sounded so natural to me and is so funny without ever calling attention to itself. It's never broad and jokey, but it's very funny and it's very, very well observed. The movie is filled with these little moments that are so spot on, whether it's the one that always comes to mind is when they get their first record, which is That Thing You Do. The first thing that Jonathan Scheck's character does as sort of the pretentious douche artist, leader of the band, James Mattingly III, is flip it over to the ballad because that's the one he really cares about.
Right.
And I just love that moment. I love it so much. And the movie is filled with little beats like that, that I don't think it gets credit for. I think it's a movie you can watch a bunch of times and start to notice things that you didn't necessarily pick up on the first time. And I don't think that I don't think mainstream audiences have really seen the movie that way. I think it's sort of just this disposable thing that comes on cable and it's cute and then I forget it. But I think it's a movie that actually warrants repeat viewings.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how to formulate this, but in the same way that, you know, all of the music is sort of an approximation of what was going on at the time, though the whole movie feels like it's taking place in some sort of encapsulated parallel kind of 60s where it's just boiled down to this kind of essence of innocence. But you get none of the, you know, cultural upheaval and the sexual revolution and stuff like that, but it doesn't matter. It would feel out of place in this movie. And it's really just about joy. I mean, a moment that stands out to me, and it's not really a subtle moment, but you know, when they hear their song on the radio for the first time, when they sort of build up of one person hears it and then they're just screaming and running around and putting it on the stereo in the appliance store. And it's just so pure and it just captures that moment. It gives me chills every time.
I you know, maybe I shouldn't admit to this on a podcast, but every one of the 8 times I saw it in the theater, and even still to this day, I would say, that scene makes me cry every time.
Yeah.
It's happiness tears. I'm not like so moved that I'm crying, but I mean, it makes me so happy because he really gets that moment so right. And I love the fact that he starts it with Faye.
Yeah, that's great.
It's such a nice touch. I mean, the characters, I think, are such believable human beings. And I'm setting all this up because there's something I'm going to say later about Tom Hanks as a writer and director. They're such believable human beings and they have like rich outside lives that are hinted at every once in a while, but never really harped on. Doug, who's on F This Movie all the time and does Watching Trailers with Doug, always points to the fact that there are references to the fact that Guy Patterson was stationed overseas in the military. And it's never really like overtly discussed. It's just this part of his past, and it sort of informed who he is because he got turned on to jazz and he got to go to these jazz clubs. And so it's not, you know, a totally superfluous detail. But it's the movie's filled with those that, like, he and Steve Zahn sort of have more of a relationship than he and anybody else that's in the band, because they knew each other before the band formed. It just feels like these people have all lived actual lives before the movie existed. It's not like they're created fresh for the purposes of the plot. Does that make sense?
No, it does. I mean, the movie doesn't. The movie kind of points up character traits or things that the characters will eventually do. I don't know if it's quite the same thing you're talking about, but, you know, you see Lenny, the Steve Zahn character, playing cards here and there.
Right.
And then it leads up to him eventually, you know, going to Vegas and running a casino. Right. And it's a little thing.
Right.
But it totally fits in. Or I can't think of another one, but that one really stands out to me. I mean, you get is Jimmy, is he the guy who, no, who's the guy who joins the army?
Oh, the bass player.
Bass player. Yeah. I can't remember his name.
He doesn't have a name.
Who doesn't have a name?
No, his name is the bass player. In the end credits, when it tells you what happens to everyone, he's just credited as TB player.
Oh, boy.
And his character is, I think, the only example of something. He's more of like just a function. And his performance is probably my least favorite in the movie too. I mean, he's fine, but he exists basically to be this joke about bass players, you know, and how disposable. Yeah. He doesn't even have a name. Ha 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 ha.
Which is sort of funny considering the entire movie is about the drummer. So
yeah, right, exactly. And now I'll tell you what, every time I watch That Thing You Do, and I watch it a lot, it makes me sad that Tom Everett Scott didn't go on to do more with his career, because I think he's really, really good in the movie. I think he's really natural and likable. And of course, at the time, everybody said, well, he's the stand-in for Tom Hanks. He's just like Tom Hanks. And I get that, but nothing else he ever did would ever come close to his work in That Thing You Do. It's very sad. His career went south quickly.
Yeah, and it's amazing to rewatch it. I hadn't really realized it. It had been many years since I'd seen the movie, but I mean, it really centers around his character, and that's, you know, as it should be. I mean, he is the most grounded. He is the most realistic and relatable, and all that stuff. And even when it eventually turns into, you know, the romance, which works for me, even though very little in the movie kind of sets it up, in the theatrical version anyway. I don't know, what was I saying? Well, I get this point in the podcast where I feel like I should be saying something, so I start going somewhere hoping I'll end up.
I think they do set up the romance, I mean, enough. And again, anything more might have been overkill, and that's one of the things I like about the movie so much, is sort of how delicate the whole thing is. We see them interact. We see it's just sort of a flirtation. We get that, like, they like each other and they belong together because they are good and decent.
Right.
And everybody else is sort of out for something else.
Sure. And it ties into that kind of rich backstory you're talking about, that you get the sense that they did, you know, hang out back in Erie, and they have known each other, you know,
right,
for a portion of their lives. So it's not like they just met when he joined the band to play drums.
And while it's certainly telegraphed that, yes, they're going to end up together because of who they are as characters, there's no single scene that points to, you know, there's no uncomfortable silence with them or some scene where it's just like they really have to set up, get it? They're going to be together, because we get that, and that just happens in the course of what the characters go through. The scene when they first play at the Mercyhurst talent show could also possibly make me cry. It doesn't as much as when they hear their song on the radio, but I love so much that first moment when the song comes together on the spot. And again, there's all these little touches that I love and that I didn't notice the first time around. Like when they first are rehearsing in the garage and they're playing it as a ballad, because everything to Jimmy is a ballad. And they finish up, and Guy has to get back to work. And he says, so it's just the one song? And they say, yeah. He says, wonderful. And, of course, that is what leads to them coming up with the name The Wonders. But right after he says wonderful, he starts to play the opening drum beat to the song.
Right, right.
He does that boom, pop, pop, boom, pop. And it's so great. And again, it took me a few viewings to realize that that's what he had just done. But I just love little touches like that. And I, the movie's filled with them.
And it's amazing the way the movie can basically appropriate things that happen to the Beatles. I mean, there are obviously a lot of references to the Beatles, most notably the fact that, that the Beatles' first big hit, Please Please Me, was originally a slow ballad. And then I think George Martin said, why don't you try playing it fast? And that happens to them.
Right.
The whole Careful Girls, He's Engaged or whatever. All that kind of, it's a lot of stuff.
Right.
But it never feels like they're stealing. It never feels like it's cheap. It never feels like it's just a wink to the Beatles. It feels like that kind of stuff probably happened with a lot of bands that never made it anywhere near as big as the Beatles. And so, why not?
Right. And that's why it works, because while there are those sort of overt references to the Beatles, they're not standing. We never get the sense that, Tom Hanks is writing them as Beatles stand-ins. They're more, they represent, all bands in the 60s sort of, who all went through sort of this same thing. And again, this is, who knows if the same thing could have happened to the Beatles, obviously they were insanely talented, and so that probably wasn't going to happen, but it's just a matter of timing and luck and breaks, mm-hmm. and chemistry with the band, and that's, I love that line that Tom Hanks has at the end, just one hit wonders, a very common tale, and yep. that's sort of yep. the acknowledgement that this was most bands in the 60s, when sort of before albums were in vogue, where bands just kind of did release singles, and so they weren't staying together for more than maybe one or two songs,
mm-hmm. And Tom Hanks plays this interesting game with all this stuff where he's making references and saying things fairly overtly. I mean, calling the band the Wonders, and so you can say one hit wonders,
mm-hmm.
Could be just this kind of like, okay, roll your eyes type of thing. Like, okay, yeah, we get it, the Wonders, but it never feels like he's, playing cheap with that kind of stuff. It's almost like the movie is not quite a fable, but I mean, it does have a slightly dreamlike quality.
Yeah.
Which I think makes a lot of the stuff that could be seen as, cheap or cheesy in a less well-made movie, works, really well here.
Yeah. Tom Hanks's character, obviously another sort of overt, Beatles reference, as Mr. White, and made even more overt in mm-hmm. the very long director's cut, where it is fully spelled out that he is a homosexual.
Right.
Because he has a date with Howie Long. So.
And if that's not going to make you gay, I don't know what will.
Did you have a chance to see the director's cut?
Yeah, I did. I watched that. I watched that yesterday. I agree with you that it's the theatrical version is better. The other one is just kind of longer.
Right.
There are some nice moments in that, building up to the Faye and Guy romance is a scene. There's a nice scene early on when they're practicing in the garage. And she brings them sandwiches. And so two things happen in that scene. One, we get to see, Faye and Guy together. And we also get to see a little bit of discord between Lenny and Jimmy when they're arguing a bit about chord progressions and stuff. And this is all before they've, really hit it big. So the cracks are there.
Right.
On the one hand, and also the romance is sort of there on the other.
And what is it on the sandwich that he refuses to have any part of?
Bologna.
And again, it's just this weird touch that, like, maybe this is personal to Tom Hanks. I don't know. But he says, no, don't ever bring me a bologna sandwich. And again, you picture a different movie where he then gives a speech about his bad history with bologna. Or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, like, here it is. It's just, oh, here's this thing we learn about Guy Patterson. He hates bologna.
Right, right.
And then we move on.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the more notable differences between the theatrical and the extended cut is that at the end of the movie, in the theatrical version, we find out the guy, he's going to become a jazz drummer.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, we're spoiling the movie. But
yeah,
whatever.
That's all right.
Yeah. Okay. but in the extended version, he basically becomes like a jazz DJ.
Right.
He calls Ron Howard's brother and says he's hanging out with Del Paxton and says, oh, you should get it on tape and stuff. And it's weird because in the, I think in the theatrical cut, he has that box of tapes that he's just recorded with him.
Yeah.
But they just re-recorded the dialogue and went a different direction. It works. It really kind of works either way, but it's just it kind of makes more sense for him to continue drumming because that's what you want him to do. You don't want him to, you know, become a DJ.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I enjoy the extended cut. Again, just as a fan of the movie, I'm just happy to spend sort of more time in this world and more time with these characters and know more about them and all that stuff. But as a movie, I don't think it works at all. But I honestly don't think that was ever Tom Hanks. It's not called the director's cut, I think, for a reason. It's just like, if you like the movie, here's some extra stuff. But I don't think... You know, he claims that this is sort of the true version of the movie or whatever, because a lot of time is spent. A lot of the additions seem to focus on Charlize Theron's character and her sort of burgeoning romance with the dentist. And sort of we just focus more on sort of the split between her and Guy. And it's something that I like a lot in the theatrical cut. I like that he has this life in Erie and it kind of falls apart. And I like a lot of their scenes and their dialogue makes me laugh in the car and stuff. When she says, I'm going to see my boyfriend's music group. I love that she says music group. It's such a, this is going to turn into the Chris Farley show. Every podcast, I'm like, I don't want to just gush about a movie, but man, I can't stop gushing about that thing you do. But yeah, way more time is devoted to that in the extended cut.
Yeah. There's a lot of scenes that show you things that they talk about later on, like someone will reference something that happened off screen. And then in the extended cut, they show you that scene.
Right. And again, that's one of the things I like in the theatrical cut too, is that they do just sort of talk about events that you don't necessarily have to have seen to understand, you know, we can fill in the blanks pretty much, you know?
And I'm mentioning Charlize Theron. There are a lot of people in this movie who, some who go on to do things, some who never did, you know, a lot of stuff as notable again, and just cameos from people I either forgot were in there or didn't expect. It's great to see Peter Scolari in there.
Yeah, and, right. Bryan Cranston shows up.
That's the name I was trying to think of. Yeah, I mean, there are all these like
Gus Grissom.
Sure, Kevin Pollak. Just a lot of great stuff. So it's
Giovanni Ribisi and Rita Wilson
as the most forgiving drummer to get kicked out of a band ever.
But again, I love that he becomes the surrogate guy in the Patterson family, and he's working at the electronic store, and he's having dinner with them the night that they're watching him on the Hollywood showcase.
He's so excited for the band that he missed out being part of.
He's the Pete Best of the Wonders, you know.
I don't know if Pete Best was ever that thrilled to watch the Beatles.
I suspect he was not. I think maybe he wasn't. My favorite cameo in the movie, I think, belongs to Jonathan Demme.
Yes.
As the director of the Rick and Anita movie, just because that scene makes me laugh. And now I'm going to jump to something else that I wanted to talk about. I had the misfortune a few weeks ago of seeing Larry Crown, which is Tom Hanks's only other feature directing credit. He hasn't written or directed a movie in 15 years. And of course, as somebody who loves That Thing You Do, I keep asking myself, boy, when is Tom Hanks going to write and direct another movie? The world needs more movies from him, if they're anything like That Thing You Do. And Larry Crown came out this summer, and it has it couldn't be more different from That Thing You Do. As I go on and on about what a realistic universe That Thing You Do plays in, how believable these characters are and their interactions and their dialogue with one another, Larry Crown is the polar opposite. Larry Crown takes place in movie world where no one is a human being. Everyone is just a movie character, and they all speak in these cutesy sound bites and clever lines. And it broke my heart to watch it fall apart. And the reason that I even brought this up was because there are two references to That Thing You Do in the movie. And I think I was the only person in the theater who caught them and laughed. And they were two of the only moments that I enjoyed myself in Larry Crown. One is there's a reference. Oh, Rita Wilson again has a cameo as a bank teller. and her last name is Gamelgard, which of course is the last name of Liv Tyler's last good kiss.
Oh, that's right.
Dave Gamelgard. Sure. Yeah. So there's one. So, you know, that's just like somebody that Tom Hanks knew growing up, had the last name Gamelgard. Right. So he just keeps working him into movies. And the other is Cedric the Entertainer plays a neighbor who is running a year round yard sale, because that's a quirky thing that real people do. And at one point, the scooter gang that Larry Crown has joined, because that's a real thing that real people do, all pull up to the yard sale at once. And Cedric the Entertainer looks and says, "We're being invaded," which, of course, that's what made me think of it, was the Jonathan Demme scene, because right. Barry Sobel as Goofball gets the great, "We're being invaded." Those are the two best parts of Larry Crown.
That's too bad. I mean, maybe there's a reason Tom Hanks hasn't done more of this since then. I mean, he's so good in almost everything. At least he gives off the veneer of being great in everything he does, although right. that's obviously not the case. That is too bad. Because I think that the fact that Tom Hanks did That Thing You Do and the sort of Tom Hanks vibe that it has, as sort of cool, like, you know, it's Hollywood, but it's not really Hollywood. It's, you know, he's the great guy next door who makes millions of dollars. Like, he's just gives it an extra kind of shot in the arm. It's too bad that Larry Crown is not. If only Julia Roberts played bass.
Oh my gosh. Like you said, That Thing You Do feels like such an extension sort of Tom Hanks as a person, the sensibility of it, the humor in it. And Larry Crown feels like an extension of like Gary Marshall or somebody, you know, just right. like somebody that I expect much less from. So it really made me sad. But you know, at least there's still That Thing You Do. Do you have a favorite song in the movie?
I mean, That Thing You Do obviously stands out, mm-hmm. But that is an obvious choice, and you hear it a billion times. So let me see if I can find a soundtrack listing here.
Okay, it's tough. I mean, I like them all for different reasons.
Sure, sure. You know, you don't hear that much of "All My Only Dreams" in the movie, mm-hmm. and I have a feeling that if you listen to the entire thing, it's maybe not as great as that snippet sounds. I mean, it's supposed to be a ballad, but. You know, there's some nice chord changes in there that, you know, yeah. definitely catch that sort of 60s romantic vibe.
Right. I'm a big fan of the song that opens the movie, which is "Loving You Lots and Lots."
Which that is delightfully repetitive.
Exactly. And again, I love that's sort of like, here's where music is at. I mean, it's obviously compressed in such a short time frame, but like the early 50s, you know, it was so sort of simplistic before rock and roll really came around. And so I like that it compresses that whole metamorphosis just into the first 20 minutes of the movie, where it's like, here's where music was at, and rock and roll is going to show up in about 20 minutes and change things.
Yeah. I mean, the movie moves very quickly in that way. And it kind of encapsulates those moments in the same way that we get just very quick shot during their Hollywood showcase of like a screaming girl sitting next to an old guy looking kind of disapproving. It's right. enough to just suggest that, you know, you have this generational shift going on without getting into the specifics of it. It's just, you know, it suggests it.
Right.
Great.
Right. If I do have a complaint about the movie, and I guess I do sort of have one, it's that it does fall victim to the trope of the magical black man.
Yes. I mean, from the, yeah, he's, His character is, you know, a little suspect to begin with, and then you get the final shot of the movie, which really, Tom Hanks?
Yeah, right.
I mean, and it breaks, you know, it breaks that fourth wall of the dream world right. and stuff, so it fits, but that's definitely a kind of Hollywood moment.
Yeah. And it's unfortunately that it's part of sort of a cliche at this point. And I like Abba Babatunde, and he had shown up in a lot of Jonathan Demme stuff, so it's great to see that connection. But yeah, it's his character's yeah. fine, but at the end when he's just sort of all knowing and he's, you know,
yeah, he sort of has to kind of like, we got to wrap this up, folks. So let's yeah,
right.
get together.
It's right. And I'm just such a fan of. again, I'm not the world's biggest fan of the Ethan Embry's performance, but I love Tom Everett Scott. I already talked about, I think Jonathan Cheick does such a great sort of self-serious, tortured artist kind of prick, but without ever being overtly villainous.
Yeah, yeah.
If that makes sense. Steve Zahn, I think, is incredibly funny in the movie.
Yes, Steve Zahn really stands out for me. I mean, besides you know, the Guy Patterson character, Steve Zahn's kind of, you know, goofy, funny Beatle, funny Wonder.
Right.
He has a lot of great lines.
Well, that's the thing. It's so rare to see a movie, especially sort of an ensemble movie like this. There's always going to be like the funny one, you know. Right. A few weeks ago, I had to watch for DVD Verdict. I watched Take Me Home Tonight, the Topher Grace, like, all-night party movie. And there's an actor in that movie named Dan Fogler, I think is his name. And you'd recognize him if you saw him. He's sort of a short, stout guy. And he's always cast as the funny one, in air quotes. And it's so rare that the funny one is actually funny. And that's one of the nice things about Steve Zahn's performance, is that everything he says is genuinely funny. I mean, it's well-written, but his timing is also really, really excellent. And it's almost like the Steve Zahn performance that I've been chasing, because I will seek stuff out that he is in. And he's been good in other stuff, and he's been funny in other stuff. But a lot of times it seems to rest on this idea of, like, I'm Steve Zahn, I'm funny, without ever actually being funny.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason that performance works is because he's playing a band member type from the 60s. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's sort of encapsulating that, you know, Beatles or Monkees-esque. There's someone who, like, has to be funny.
Right.
And he is funny, but he's also playing it up to kind of say, well, this is what happened then. There always had to be someone who was funny.
Right.
I'm that guy. So, you know.
Right.
Same as there's always had to be a bass player that no one cared about. Yeah, right. So he's playing a character that's funny, and he's playing an idea that's funny too.
Right. And as much as, I mean, obviously each of the four band members fall into these very obvious sort of archetypes, to the point where Tom Hanks at the end even spells them out, where he'll say, you know, Lenny is the fool and Jimmy is the talent. And but I don't ever feel watching the movie like I'm being sort of hammered over the head with it. They exist as people, and everyone is sort of maybe a little bit of something else, if that makes sense, where it's not, they're not necessarily locked into these roles at all times. So it's like, yeah, when it's spelled out for you at the end, you can reflect back and say, yes, absolutely, they were sort of in these boxes. But I didn't feel like going through the movie that I always knew what everyone was going to say or do according to their function in the band.
Sure. They're character types, but they're not cliches.
Right. Right. And I do have to say that I, especially in 1996, especially in That Thing You Do, I nursed a huge crush on Liv Tyler.
She's cute. She's very cute in that movie.
Oh my gosh. And again, you don't see her doing enough of, I think, what she does in this movie. Every once in a while, a director will remember how to use her. Mm-hmm. And I think Super, actually, which we talked about earlier, is very smart about the way that it uses her, because I think it does something. I don't want to give away anything about Super, but right, I think it uses the qualities that she possesses in That Thing You Do to it twists them enough to the movie's advantage. I think
she manages to drive the plot without being a huge part of it.
Right.
And in a way that's believable.
Right, because all those things that we love about her are there, but there's something different about it. I don't want to give it away. But like, a lot of what Rainn Wilson does makes sense because it's Liv Tyler. If it was somebody else,
right.
Maybe we're not buying what he's doing.
Right. If it wasn't Liv Tyler, then we'd be, you know, even more shocked and horrified. And
exactly.
Not be rooting for Rainn Wilson. So
right. So I just love her so much in the movie, and again, she manages to play. You know, she's basically just a sort of a function of the plot, because she just needs to be the love interest or whatever. But she, again, manages to, I think, sort of flesh it out and be a real person. And more than once in the movie is given a close up or a look or a little thing that she does that just wrecks me every time I watch it. I mean, when they first start playing That Thing You Do fast. She's mm-hmm. she does her look around, like, what are you guys doing? But then the way that that scene turns, I love, because it's in the wide shot and just the two people come out and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love it. And then we cut back to her and she kind of gives this little half smile and she does this little dance to herself. And that's when you know, like, oh, she gets it. She's on board. And that allows sort of us to be on board too. Mm-hmm. Not that we're experiencing the movie through her, but it's like we get caught up in it because she is, if that makes sense.
Sure. And the whole kind of build up to the Hollywood TV showcase.
Yes.
With her, like, I mean, even in the trying on the dress kind of montage, that should be kind of, you know, here they go again. She's just so cute and just kind of sells it. The anticipation and the innocence and the kind of feeling out of her element. And
her excitement too.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we sort of understand what's at stake because we know that she's headed for a heartbreak and it's like, it's that much worse because we see just how supportive and excited she is.
I mean, the best moment in that, you know, part of the movie for her is when just before the Wonders come on and someone asks her where they're going to come out and she points and she does little like smile and it's just, it's so perfect. And it's just really like, she couldn't be happier to be there in that.
Right.
And it doesn't feel like anyone is acting. It just feels like someone is just really excited.
Yeah.
And she does that excitement, you know, so well. And it's not the same kind of excitement that the teeny bopper screaming girls, you know, it's a legitimate kind of mature,
right,
you know, just joy for not only seeing the people that she loves, you know, make it big, but just, you know, hearing the joy of the music and the joy of the, you know, the thrill of it. So it's she's great.
I love her scene with Charlize Theron too, and they really only get one moment together.
Yep.
But again, it's so pitch perfect. And you know, if you want to talk about it in sort of bigger terms, it's obviously where Guy is and where he should be, or you know, the girl that whatever. But the way that those two interact with each other, I think, is so again well observed, and that's something I've said, you know, probably too many times about the movie already. But the more movies I see, the more rare I find that quality to be in a movie, because we watch a movie and we accept a lot of things because we know we're watching a movie. And so many movies just work on movie logic where, boy, these characters don't behave like the people I know at all, but I accept it because it's a movie. So of course the guy is going to lie to the girl in order to win her heart or whatever. And we buy it because it's a movie. So when you see something like that thing you do, which I really feel like is very smart in the way that it observes the way that we interact with each other, whether it's the way we look differently at or talk differently to the girl that we like, but who we can't admit that we like, even to ourselves, or the way that there's just this strange competition between Charlize Theron and Liv Tyler in their one little moment together. And neither one is obviously willing to admit it. And Liv Tyler sort of wants to be nice, but is very quickly shut down. And I've seen that moment play out a lot of times in real life. And it's rare for a movie to sort of capture it that succinctly in that short of an amount of time.
For all those little moments that we talked about, does her kind of big speech rub you at all the wrong way?
Yeah. It does, because it feels like a big speech.
Yeah, yeah, which is too bad. I mean, it's a well-written kind of movie speech.
Right.
But, you know, considering everything we've seen up to that point, just those kind of little touches, it rings a little false. I mean, I'm not going to ding the movie for it at all, because I think it totally works in that scene, but it's just sort of too bad that
it feels written, whereas so much of the movie doesn't. I absolutely agree. I would not be, you know, surprised to learn that a lot of things in the movie were improvised, even though I don't think they were, because that's the way it feels. But yeah, that speech at the end feels like I picture Tom Hanks at the keyboard typing that out.
Right.
And I don't for most of the movie. So
it's where the music swells and the audience, you know, cheers and it's all
right.
Or tears up or whatever. But,
but I like that he was willing to sort of juxtapose those two moments. I like that it happens right after their big debut on TV, as opposed to right before or at some other point in the movie. I mean, I like how immediately after they're at their peak, you know, it's not necessarily a long drawn out decline. I mean, They play on TV. It's great. And it's over like that.
Right.
In the very next scene. And I like that. Again, like you said, the movie sort of moves along very quickly. And that's another example of that.
Yeah. I mean, speaking about juxtaposition, I mean, it's almost kind of gutsy for the movie to include as much jazz as it does. I mean, that really is the counterpoint to this kind of poppy 60s stuff. And when I think 60s, you know, this movie really kind of captures a spirit of the 60s, if not a reality of the 60s, that we all, you know, would think of when someone says 60s pop music. But, you know, the fact that the guy plays the jazz drums, I mean, jazz is not what I think of when I think of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It gives it this kind of underpinning, this consistency, this sense that, you know, the through line of music doesn't rely on this pop stuff. I don't know. It's just kind of thinking about it after watching it. It seems more remarkable that Tom Hanks was able to get it in and make it not feel at odds with the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily exist as like a direct counterpoint, because the movie right. obviously is never looking down its nose at pop music. It's a celebration of pop music, but like you said, it is, there's other music that's going on that, like you said, doesn't rely on matching suits and big all-day outdoor festivals hosted by radio personalities and stuff like that. That, and again, that Guy Patterson himself never looks down his nose at what he's doing in the Wonders. He loves it. He's playing music. He's having a great time. He's successful, but it's not necessarily what he really loves. You know, mm-hmm. what he really loves is jazz. And again, his reaction when he first meets Del Paxton, or even his reaction to the drum solo in that club, I just love
yeah.
so
great.
Much.
So great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's very smart in that way.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie with a lot of music that loves music. It's about the, you know, the joy of listening to and playing and experiencing music. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, makes it work for me, you know, as well as it does, because I, you know, I experience that when I want to listen to bands that I love, and especially from this era. So.
And as much as I think it is sort of sometimes willing to goof on some of the trappings of the day, not in the way that I think a lot of period movies do, where it's like, look at the funny clothes, look at the woman smoking next to a baby. I mean, it never plays those games, you know. But it is certainly goofing on some of the trappings, even if it is just those all day things hosted by Boss Vic Hoss or whatever, you know.
But it's just the trappings that it's goofing on, the actual underpinnings of the music. And of the sincerity of the people who played it is never
right.
You know, it's never played for laughs, really.
And I think even the things that it's kind of goofing on, I think it also has a great deal of affection for.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
I mean, I think Tom Hanks recognizes like this is a little bit silly, and this isn't necessarily how art is made, but wasn't it kind of fun, and wasn't it kind of neat, and isn't it mm-hmm. sad that, you know, that time has passed? You know.
Sure. And there, it's a movie without any real villains or any real kind of. I mean, you know, the band breaks up, and that's kind of the big dramatic, you know, climax. But there aren't a lot of stakes, really. It's just, you know, kids having fun, and you know, as their fame rises, you know, sort of the chances that they're going to implode. But even when that happens, everything turns out really well for everybody, according to the the text at the end of the movie. I mean.
Right.
Even Jimmy went on to get 2 gold records for the label that he quit.
Right, which is a great example of it would have been very easy to say like Jimmy is homeless and broke or whatever, you know, like because he was the guy that we don't like. So let's
died of a drug overdose.
Exactly. Let's give him some sort of horrible fate. But no, it rewards him. He becomes a successful music producer. Mm-hmm. And it gives him his original band name back. He's in the Herdsmen, but the fact that he is recording for Playtone again, your mind fills in like, he crawled back to them, and there's something satisfying about that without it being overly malicious or, you know, really obvious.
There's even something nice about the fact that the bass player who works in a hardware store or owns a hardware store or whatever. It's like, yeah, that sounds just about right.
Right.
Good for him. People need nails.
They do. They do. And music wasn't necessarily his first love. Absolutely. You know, it was just,
I mean, it's almost as though the band was, you know, broken up before they even got started. I mean, they were just kind of goofing around, and then they had this huge hit. So
Right, which is so much of what makes the movie so much fun is because they are sort of caught up in a whirlwind before they even realize what's happening, and I think the movie really sort of captures that sense, and that's I think part of why the shorter cut works better than the longer cut, because it really is now we're going to Hollywood to be in a movie, now we're playing the showcase on TV. I mean, it really whisks you around from event to event in a way that the extended cut doesn't, because it is taking its time with, you know, more character stuff, which is great, but it doesn't carry that same sense of sort of that whirlwind tour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, this is a good choice. Oh, you were going to.
Oh, I was just going to say, I can't stand this movie. And,
this is the big twist. I knew this podcast was going
to
have a twist.
I like to have a big twist at the end.
An M. Night Shyamalanian twist.
The twist is, I've never seen That Thing You Do. And this whole time I've been talking about Turner and Hooch.
But the twist is, so have I.
Double twist. Wow. All right. Well, thank you very much for talking about this movie with me, Eric. You know, we've basically just talked through so many like great scenes and lines and moments, and I shouldn't want to like go and put it on right now, but that's exactly what I wanted to.
I know, and I shouldn't have That Thing You Do in my head happily, but it's I've been singing that to myself the rest of the month, and I'll be perfectly fine with it after hearing it like 20 billion times.
I will never tire of that song.
That's a great song.
Yeah, I love it. All right, well, thank you for being on the podcast. Hopefully you'll come back soon.
Hopefully.
I've been toying with the idea of like teasing the next appearance. Oh, so like at the end of the Cowboys and Aliens. Appearance? Your next appearance, yeah.
Well, I think it might be the double feature we talked
about.
That's
right. So the tease would be what? Like
Don't feed me after midnight.
So everyone, don't feed Eric after midnight.
See if you could puzzle through that.
I know what it is.
Wrapped in an enigma.
It's Turner and Hooch.
Again. Turner and Hooch too, because it doesn't.
It's Tuner and Hooch. All right. That's the worst. All right, bye, everybody.